A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Those ominous words are at the start of the book of Exodus and transition us from the story of Joseph to the story of the people of the Israelites. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. There's a lot in those words. Joseph, you might recall, had found favor in Pharaoh's sight. He was given a privileged seat in Egypt. But this new Pharaoh didn't know that. Joseph, you might recall, had saved Egypt, or rather, God had used him to save Egypt from a drought. But this new Pharaoh didn't know that. Joseph, you might recall, was the great grandson of Abraham. He was an heir to the promises of land and descendants and blessing. God promised to use Joseph and his people to bless the entire world. But this new Pharaoh didn't know that. And so many years, perhaps centuries after Joseph, his people, the Israelites, became an unknown people. And as so often the case, they became feared and hated. You could say there was a race relations problem between the Egyptians and the Israelites, but that would be underselling it. The Israelites were oppressed, enslaved. Eventually, Pharaoh even attempted genocide by trying to kill a generation of boys. Things were bad. You can imagine the Israelites whispering to one another at night, longing to be free, hatching up plans to escape. But to where? Plus, it would have been dangerous. Pharaoh was so ruthless. So they kept quiet in public. Meanwhile, their nighttime hatchings and cries all rise up to God who hears them, God who remembers them. There arose a king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, but God knew Joseph, and God intended to liberate his people. A battle ensues, a battle between God and Pharaoh for the Israelites. It's unlike anything you've ever seen, with devastating plagues instead of planned defenses between armies. If you haven't read it, give it a try. As usual, the book is better than the movie. Also, it's not as long as Keith makes it sound like it is. The battle truly is between God and Pharaoh, not Egypt and Israel. God continually showing power and strength and an unbending desire to bring the people out of Egypt. And Pharaoh showing such stubbornness, unwilling to release the people he fears and hates. If you read through it, it starts to feel like this 10th and final plague is almost inevitable. Like this is what it's going to take for Pharaoh to surrender. It's going to take the returning of his own horrific action upon him. The firstborn sons of Egypt will die. And only then will Pharaoh let the Israelites leave. He'll demand it, in fact. It's almost more of an eviction than an escape. As an aside, what makes this battle between God and Pharaoh so hard for all of us is that the collateral damage is so immense, especially in the last plague. It's not just Pharaoh who loses a child, but every Egyptian, and at the hand of God, no less. There are many good reasons, perhaps, for this plague, but none make it palatable to me. Maybe we should be bothered by it, bothered by the violence. Maybe it disturbs us because it's disturbing. The Jewish tradition includes this great story in which God admonishes the angels for rejoicing when the Egyptians die. We can debate if it was necessary for God to act so, but it's a devastating story either way, isn't it? Anyway, in the middle of this story, before the Israelites leave, in fact, before the plague even hits, we're interrupted with a description of how this whole thing should be remembered. It's strange, isn't it? You'd think that on that fateful night, the focus would be on the mechanics of the survival, what to pack, how to leave. But all that's really accomplished by God, and so almost everything that's said is about how to remember this later on. The whole thing has an eye toward future generations. Because this event, this act of a God who remembers the people, a God who knew them when Pharaoh did not, this event of liberation becomes the defining event for the people for generations to come. They'll set their calendars by it. They'll reenact it every year, entering into the story of this rushed exodus. They'll eat the same unleavened bread and tell the same stories. For centuries, for millennia, they won't just remember God liberating the people. They'll join in the liberation. God interrupts our story to give instructions so that later generations can join them at the table. So that later generations can also become the liberated. It will be what defines them from then on, and it will define God too. God the liberator, they the liberated. Many centuries later, at one of these Passover meals, one of these meals of remembrance, Jesus sat down to eat with 12 of his disciples. And just like the night of that first Passover, this too was an interruption in a liberating event. As Jesus sat down at that table, he took the meal that had been given to him so many centuries earlier and made something new out of it, a new meal. And in this new meal, which we call communion, we also remember and enter into a liberation, a violent liberation, one that took place on a cross and in a tomb. But in that story, in this new story, the liberating God is not the final violent actor in a battle, but the final victim. And in this new meal, it is not a specific people invited to remember, but all people. The Passover meal was transformed by Christ for us, that we might also become a people known as a liberated people with a liberating God. It's beautiful. The idea that as we kneel around this table, we become the liberated again and again, liberated from sin and death and the ways they try to hold us down, liberated from fear and hopelessness and purposelessness. It's not maybe what you always think about as you kneel at this table, but I invite you, as you receive this tiny piece of bread and this tiny cup of wine, I invite you to think, whew, do I feel liberated? I think we should try it together. Repeat it after me. Whew, do I feel liberated? Good job. There's just one wrinkle here that hasn't let me go this whole week. When I think back on that first Passover meal, the one that our new meal of communion is rooted in, I can't help but realize that most of us in this room have more in common with the Egyptians than the Israelites. The Israelites were an oppressed people. I bet even before they were enslaved. And had there been a movement to end their slavery, they probably would have ended up as second-class citizens afterward. The Egyptians, on the other hand, well, they had it much differently. And I'm not talking about Pharaoh and his cronies. I'm talking about your average Egyptian, the ones who worked at the bank and taught in the school and coached their kids' soccer team. They weren't the oppressors. They didn't own all these Israelite slaves. That was reserved for a few. But they were privileged. They got to have homes and jobs and freedom and access that all the Israelites didn't have. They may have even benefited from the Israelites' oppression, from the roads and structures that were built. We in this room aren't oppressors either, but we are privileged. Most of us have benefited from the money, education, or zip codes we were born into. Most of us have benefited from our race. And maybe we've even benefited from oppression, from land that was taken many years ago for our ancestors to have, and fortunes that were built on the backs of slaves or the underpaid outcasts of society. Maybe we've benefited from cheap gadgets and cheap clothing made by the global poor, from housing laws and education that were designed for us and skipped over others because of their race. We aren't oppressors, but are we benefactors of oppression? I mention all of this to ask a really hard question for me. So what does it mean for us to join in this meal? What does it mean for us to call ourselves the liberated when in this world we aren't the ones in most need of liberation? It's a tough question. Two responses. First, for most of us here, to eat this bread and drink this wine is to cast off our power and privilege, our positions bolstered by oppression, and identify instead with those who are still being liberated. We might not actually give up our houses and jobs and education. Not sure that would do much good anyway. But by removing the mantle of our privilege, we might be able to join with those still being liberated, walk with them, and aid them in their liberation. You see this when you set aside your own home for the evening and eat a meal in the church basement with those IHN families who have no home. You see this when you set aside your presumptions and ask someone who is black what it's like to live afraid in their own city. You see this when you set aside your cheap gadget and learn about the poor girl who made it across the world, and then maybe give some money to help her live a better life. An author once said that the Passover meal is an antidote to cruelty. I like that, an antidote to cruelty. Throughout the Old Testament, the meal serves as a reminder to the people that they were once slaves in a foreign land, and so now they ought to show compassion among those oppressed among them. By identifying themselves in this meal as the liberated, they were able to walk with those whom God was still at work liberating. And the same is true for us. In this meal of liberation, we cast aside the worldly mantles of privilege and prestige and pick up instead the unfamiliar mantle of freedom, that we might walk with those who are not yet free, are not yet liberated, are not yet living this full life. But that can only happen when we ourselves are also liberated, which is my second response to that tough question. What does this meal mean for us who have more in common with the Egyptians than the Israelites? Well, we need to be liberated too. Because those mantles of power and prestige and privilege, they might give us comfort. They might also, though, become a prison. We have to maintain them and defend them. They force us to be less compassionate, less willing to side with the poor, the minority, the other. They make us afraid of losing what is ours. It's exhausting, right? We have more in common with the average Egyptian than the average Israelite. But maybe the average Egyptian needs to be liberated too. So come one and all to this meal, this sacramental meal of remembrance. God, who grants freedom and life, invites you. In this meal, you will walk with those still being liberated in our world. In this meal, you are counted among the liberated. In this meal, you are set free to live. Amen. Let's stand and sing together number 326. 326.